In a world where one woman locks herself inside a quiet studio and doesn't come out until the podcast is done, welcome to Spotlight Conversations with Donna Reed, a place you can get connected with Donna and her friends and listen in on some great conversation. And thankfully, unlike the intro you just heard, it's a drama-free zone. You're welcome. Now, as we listen to a bit of music from the amazing Mark Sparrow to lead us in, it's my pleasure to introduce the one, the only, Donna Reed.
Thank you for joining me today. You want to find out more about the podcast and the voiceover work I do, go to spotlightconversations.com on Instagram and on Facebook at Spotlight Conversations. And you can also find me at Donna Reed VO. All right, this is a different topic. I'm just trying this out. It's not specifically about media. We're going to talk to a tech guru, and he's going to talk about how to stay safe online, how to keep yourself safe when you're buying something online, just generally safety measures with technology. I'm also going to ask my next guest about media and technology and his thoughts on AI. Michael Farnham is in the studio today, Chief Tech Officer at Set Solutions. He is also the founder and president of HughesSecCon. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. Very informative. This guy knows his stuff. He's also a cyber technology board member and advisor, and he knows a lot about technology. He's here today because I don't know a whole lot about technology, but I'm learning. Michael Farnham, thank you for joining me today on Spotlight Conversations. Great to have you in the studio today.
Absolutely, Donna. Thanks for having me. I'm finally glad to connect. I know we've talked about this a few times, and so finally being able to connect is great.
So how did HughesSecCon get started?
So I've been in the cybersecurity and IT industry since way back in 1994 or something. And probably about 2008, 2009 timeframe, I started or partnered with a group here locally. It's kind of like a user group that got together to talk about, you know, cybersecurity topics. Mm-hmm. And we would get, and Peter went to a few of those. I'm assuming it's okay to mention
him. Oh, sure. Yeah. My husband is in IT, yes, and he's a patient man, so we'll put that out there.
So I think Peter and I may have even met through that, and we would have 20 or 30 people that would show up every month. And in this industry, like a lot of industries, we have conferences all over the place, but all we had was really big conferences, or we had local conferences that were very, very, shall we say, they're just driven by vendors, so the content wasn't very good. Mm-hmm. They weren't community type of members, so you either had to pay a whole bunch and travel somewhere, or you had to do something locally and the content wasn't very good. So me and a couple of friends decided to start up HughesSecCon, and did it way back in 2010 and had about 120 people show up, which was good then. And,
yeah.
Now we're pushing 800 to 900 people and have been doing it since 2010. And that's it. I mean, it's
when you get together every month to meet, what's the most important topic you try to get across to attendees?
So we get together annually now because we don't have like a user group like we used to. I've considered getting back together every month. But for right now, we do it annually. The topics range, since we are all generally cybersecurity professionals, the topics can be everything from everyday online security, like we were talking about, safety, that kind of thing, all the way up to major topics around everybody that's listening to you probably has heard the term ransomware, and it's something that's in the news. So we talk about topics like that as well. Any kind of safety and security generally of larger organizations, governmental organizations, that kind of thing is what we tend to talk about. And we do anything from really high level type of topics all the way to people showing how to actually hack things, and just know that's not a bad term in our world. A hacker is not a bad person necessarily, not good or bad. That's just a general term, and we can get into that if you want. And we do crazy things like learn how to pick locks, stuff like that. The basic idea is that if we have to know how a bad guy, a bad person is going to attack us in order to know how to defend against it. So we can learn those same things.
I'm going to talk about your background in a minute, but because you talked about hacker and, you know, there's your interpretation a bit different than what, you know, most people who aren't in technology think. The TV shows we watch on Netflix and so on, are they pretty much true as far as when they talk about tech people? Go ahead, he's shaking his head.
No, they're not. So all of them are Hollywoodized, or, you know, they're glamorized to make them look like all the shows you see where you see, I mean, you'll see stuff as silly as two people on one keyboard doing things. That makes absolutely no sense to us. There is one show that is very, very accurate as far as the actual act of doing things. And that was a show, I don't think it's on anymore, called iRobot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So they actually reached out to somebody and a couple of people in our industry and asked them to make the actual act of hacking something very technically accurate. So they dramatized all the other pieces, but they made that very technically accurate. I know one of the guys who helped work on that, and it's very, very accurate. But all of the things where you see with the flashing lights and all, you're going into it, none of that stuff is real. It's actually, the hacking game is kind of, it's a little bit boring sometimes. It's all about solving problems. And if you're an engineering type of person and you want to like build something in your house, but you've never done it before, or you have some remedial knowledge of it, you go do something. If that doesn't work, you start over and do it again. And that's the same way with hacking.
So the blacklist, not really as legit as we would like to believe.
No. I mean, you know, I have a healthy distrust of authority. So the blacklist is appeals to me, but all of the hacking.
Okay.
Not correct.
Just thought I'd ask that question. All right. You're growing up. What made you know that technology was your future? And at Laterno University, is that where you said, hey, this is the field for me?
No, Laterno, I got a business degree. Okay. All of the knowledge that I have built up and accumulated over the years is through either practice, actually doing, are working with friends or something like that. I grew up way backwoods, deep south Mississippi, with very, very little access to technology. But I happened to be in one class with about six or seven students. It sounds braggy, I don't mean it to be, but it was called a gifted class. But our teacher, Miss Guy, had a computer. This was when I was in fifth grade. It was probably very few computers. My mom worked in a place that had computers, so I had a bit of access. So I got to play with those things and got really interested. And then when I was probably in late junior high, early high school, my dad had a friend who had a computer that he got a new computer. He got that to me. So I got to play with that. So all of that really made me interested. And then of all things, we talk about Hollywood things, the movie War Games.
Okay.
It's very popular, even out of technology circles, Matthew Broderick back in the 80s. Some of that stuff was actually some of that stuff fairly technically accurate, especially for back then. So that got me really interested, and that's just kind of where I went to.
After college, did you ever have, we'll call it a case, a project that you found the answer to?
Oh, absolutely. There's some things I'm not trying to be mysterious. Some things I can't talk about, I was never with like the NSA or CIA or anything like that. So there's nothing usually mysterious, but I did, in one of the organizations we had to keep track of people who were doing things on the network that weren't supposed to be doing certain things and using our network for certain things. And we had several people that were doing pretty bad things that we had to take care of. And then over the years, as I've worked in different organizations doing like consulting work and stuff like that, we've had several instances of actual attackers trying to get into environments that we've had to stop. So that's actually a pretty regular occurrence when you're in cybersecurity. I mean, that's what you're doing is guarding against those. So everybody's got a bunch of crazy stories they could tell.
Are you able to turn it off when you walk away from the office or the computer at the end of the day? Or are you always thinking, oh, well, maybe if I had done that or asked this question or...
Yeah, I'm able to turn it off more now because I've reached a point in my career where I'm not daily in operations of trying to secure an organization. I'm working for a company that tries to sell services and products to help organizations do those. So I made that decision to get out of the operational and day-to-day environment a while back. So I'm able to turn it off. But back then, I have a friend here in the office with me today who's the title is Chief Information Security Officer, and goes by the acronym CISO is what we say.
Okay.
And he has to deal with the operational. And most of your listeners probably won't know it, but there was a really big issue that came out, a big vulnerability that got that came out earlier or this weekend, and he's having to deal with all of the fallout from that. If anybody's curious, go look at, it's called LogForge or Log4j.
Mm-hmm.
You look that up, type that in Google, you'll get all kinds of techno babble that'll probably put you to sleep. Actually, if you want to look it up, it's LOG and the number 4 and the letter J.
Okay.
That's been a big issue this last week, and it's a vulnerability. You hear that all the time. People that are on you probably heard the term patching. That kind of stuff. Those are the things that everybody's having to do this week is patch, because this one piece of software has got a vulnerability in it, and it's ubiquitous. Everybody uses this piece of software. So,
such as?
If you write any kind of software that you're going to sell to somebody else, there's this concept called open source where you're going to start write a program. You don't want to write it from scratch, from front to back. You go reuse other people's code that they've written. So that's called open source. People allow that to be used. So there was a particular piece of open source software that a lot of people use across the industry for a lot of different projects. It is almost in every company in the world probably, and had a vulnerability that was really bad. So everybody's having to fix that. So that's the daily thing that they deal with.
We're going to talk about shopping online. Of course, we do it even if it's not the holiday season. Everybody's shopping online. What can people do to stay safe?
So when you're doing Christmas shopping, almost all of those places make you set up some kind of account.
Mm-hmm.
Like you get login and password.
Right.
There's two or three things that you can do to really make sure you stay safe. One is you don't want to reuse passwords in all those different sites. Now, the common objection that, you know, all my relatives have had and everybody that talks to me about this is, oh, I can't remember all of those things. And that's fine. The other thing you can do to not use the same password is you can go get what's called a password generator or password manager tool. There's one called 1Pass, there's one called Pass, passkey, other things like that. They're really not that complicated to. It sounds intimidating, but they're really not complicated to install. And I use it myself as a cybersecurity professional. And what it enables you to do is really just remember one password. And if you make that password very complicated and hard to guess and hard to somebody who's got a computer to try to guess it all a bunch, it's hard to call crack. Then you can have that one password. And then that password manager will hold all of the passwords for you in all these different sites and will even generate very secure passwords for you so you don't have to remember them. And so when you go to a website, like say you're going to Amazon or you're going to your banking site, it will automatically fill that password in for you. And you don't see it. You don't even know what it is, but it's a long string of numbers and letters and special characters and spaces and that kind of stuff. And it will create that password for you. You don't have to remember anything but the one password. And that will help your security tremendously right there. Because if you use your dog's name and then a 1 or a 2 or a 3, somebody's going to guess that.
People do that?
Absolutely.
It's more common than you think.
You even get that much. There's a lot of times it's just password one or something like that.
So getting one pass is a great way to keep you safe if you're going to shop online.
Absolutely. And then the third thing I would do was at any of those sites that allow you, and this is a pretty common term, I think, these days out there in the world, if they allow you to do what we call two-factor authentication or multi-factor authentication, all it is a little app that you can put on your phone. And you, when you log in, you have that LastPass. It has your username and your password. Mm-hmm. Your password in there for you, then it'll pop up a screen and it'll say enter this code, and that's just an app that gets generated on your phone. There's a code that gets generated on your app on your phone. That way, what it is a one-time password. So not only do you have your username and a very long string, hard to guess password, you also have a one-time password that never is the same ever. So if somebody doesn't have that app, doesn't have that ability, then that they won't be able to log in. And all of those accounts, all of those systems have a way to do that, and they've got very detailed instructions on how to do it. Mm-hmm. You can use the same application for every one of them to generate codes. Those three things, you'll be very secure.
Is it almost safer to shop online using those three methods you mentioned rather than going out there shopping with your credit card and making a purchase?
Well, those three things will guard your credit card.
Oh, okay.
You would still go put your credit card into those systems. Mm-hmm. But if you've got that login and password in those systems. Now, if you're going somewhere that you don't, a lot of those allow you to check out as a guest.
Right, right.
And you don't have to create a login and password to those. Then you just want to make sure, like the bar up in where you type in google.com or whatever URL or address bar, you just want to make sure that that's got a green lock up there, which means that it's an encrypted site. You want to make sure that, I mean, a lot of people want to shop in different places. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend you try to shop on reputable places. That's, you know, your Etsy's and your Amazon's and your Walmart's, Target's, that kind of thing. Those are going to tend to be more secure.
Okay.
And some obscure shop out there that, you know, has that one thing you want, but you just get a little, are they doing this the right way?
I guess what I'm trying to say is it's safer to shop at Target online than it would be to go into Target and make a credit card purchase?
That's a very good question. So I would say that it's not necessarily safer, that it's just different risks.
Okay.
So in order for a Target.com to for you to lose your password or lose your card information and that kind of stuff on there, they would have to go through a pretty serious hack to have that happen. Now, Target did get a few years ago, hard if you remember that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But that was actually, they got to the credit cards through a store. Without getting into the details, it wasn't because of online shopping, it was through the store. Now, if you've heard of credit card skimmers and that kind of stuff, you can have the credit card machines in a Target. People who want to skim that, get that data and steal that data, they can go in there and put a thing on there and have it where it looks just the same as the credit card machine itself, and it'll skim your credit card data. That's getting more rare these days.
Is it? All right.
The credit cards themselves with the chips and that kind of thing are getting more secure.
And also the days where you had receipts and maybe your credit card number was on the receipts, that's not even...
You can't do that anymore. I mean, that's a huge violation of what we call payment card. The payment card industry has set up their own standards for security.
Okay.
If you're a store and you violate those things, there are huge fines. Your credit card fees go up if they catch you. It's really bad. Yeah, they've done a really good job of fixing those issues, but from, you know, 10, 15 years ago, it's we're much better space now.
Well, that's good to know. My next question, mm-hmm. spam calls.
Oh, gosh.
Even though we have stuff on the phone, not the landline anymore, and it catches it, or you're in your car, you know, it says it's a spam call likely, and you go X.
There's not much you can do about it.
Okay.
There's really not. And if you want to have some entertainment, you can pick up the call and mess with them. I will forewarn you, if you do that, I've had one get very mad at me, and they entered my phone number into their system to call me about every 2 minutes. So I had to just send all my calls that I didn't recognize off. There's a setting in your phone that you can do that.
Yes.
You do have the ability, and I'm pretty sure it's in Android and iPhone both, where you can send any phone number that you do not recognize, you can send it immediately to just go to voicemail.
Right.
A lot of times you'll get a lot fewer fewer calls that way, because they'll hang up before it goes to voicemail. So that'll give you some relief. The anti-spam stuff that AT&T or Verizon or T-Mobile, whoever, put on your phone, that works decently well. It's still annoying because you see it pop up. And even though it's not very effective, I still do recommend going out on the do not call list.
Do you?
Yeah, I still recommend doing that, because there are some people who are going that aren't really, they're not bad actors. They're just people who, that's their method of business, is trying to call people. And a lot of those companies do, especially the more reputable ones, will recognize that and won't call you. And there you will have some reduction, probably not totally recognizable reduction, but it's not bad to do it. You just have to remember to renew it, I think, every couple of 3 years or something.
The amount of spam calls.
It costs it. Well, it's the same thing as spam emails. It costs so little. The systems are so simple that the per call price or per email price is in the pennies, and even sometimes sub pennies. Mm-hmm. Therefore, if you get one person that picks up and does something out of 1,000 calls, you've made money. So the business model is absolutely legitimate from that perspective. It's just that it's used by people trying to scam you as well, not just legitimate business owners.
So there's no way around the spam calls.
There's some investigation going on, and I don't have the latest off the top of my head, but I know I heard a news article not too long ago that the FCC is looking into it a little bit more. A lot of it comes down to just I can't remember all of the issues with it. Some of it's technology, some of it's purely like kind of free communication, free speech type of issues as well. So there's different issues wrapped up around it as to why they haven't fully tackled it, which is why the carriers have tried to handle some of it.
But spam emails, same idea?
Same idea. It's getting better, and it's very cyclical, because you'll get spam emails and all of a sudden you'll get a bunch of them knocked out and you won't see some of them for a while. And then the spammers catch up to the technology, and then they get past whatever filters. And, you know, we had our own issues communicating on this podcast because of Gmail blocking some spam, or blocking what it perceived as spam. So they get a little over anxious sometimes and block stuff that's, but they're trying to catch up. So that'll always be a fight. It's a technology battle back and forth. So
you can't really be on a no call list for email. So what's the one thing people can do to keep some of the spam down with email?
I hate to say it, but I mean, you kind of have to proactively go mark, because you can do it in Gmail and a lot of email programs. You can go proactively mark those emails as junk or as spam, and that will help the engine kind of learn what they would call machine learning, or whatever. The intelligence of the program will learn after a while that certain things match certain patterns and will block those. A lot of that's already built into a lot of those tools, so, and they proactively keep up with it. But generally it's just marking that stuff anytime you know that it's definitely spam, just mark it. And but the other thing is that if you know you're missing something, I very consistently, at least once or twice a week, go in and check my spam and junk inboxes to make sure I'm not missing legitimate stuff, because a lot of can get caught up in it as well. So I recommend doing the other as well.
I'm talking with Michael Farnham, Chief Technology Officer at Set Solutions, Hugh Setcon, founder, president, cybersecurity tech board member. We talked earlier about vulnerabilities. How do they start and how do you fix them?
So vulnerability is all in software. Anybody who is writing a program, the issue with it is if you consider like infrastructure on bridges and roads and that kind of thing, engineering to build those things has been around for thousands and thousands of years, and we've done nothing but essentially get better at that because we've learned from our mistakes. Mm-hmm. Software engineering, writing, developing programs has literally only been around less than 100 years to any great extent, if more like 70 or something. So we've still got a whole lot to learn. And the problem is the same way if you looked at the first bridge that was built, it probably fell over, somebody went through a court, with a horse and fell through, and there were mistakes made. It's the same way with software engineering. Every developer that goes in, we don't have really strict guidelines that says you will develop a program in this way, like you do with building a bridge. That just doesn't exist, and it may never really fully exist, because it's there's a lot more into developing a program all the way around, I think, than the building a bridge. Some people may argue with me there, but that's essentially what it is that the developers are there writing a program and they make a mistake somewhere in there that allows a vulnerability to happen. And what that vulnerability is just, I can take control of your computer, I can send bad stuff to you, there's a whole lot of technical complication there. But essentially, what happens is you've got a person that's a hacker, who's either a good hacker or a bad hacker. Mm-hmm. We can talk about that, but they're looking to see if this program, this application will do something that it's not supposed to do. Can I push this command to this application and make it do something that it wasn't designed to do? Right. They're allowing me to break into it. And so whoever finds that vulnerability, either if they're a bad person, a bad hacker, then they take advantage of that to try to steal your credit card info, that kind of thing. If they're a good hacker, then they generally let whoever is creating that program know you got a vulnerability right here. And that developer can then take action to go write new code to do what you would call a patch, fix that vulnerability, and then release the new version. So anytime you see like an update on your phone or an application that gets updated, a lot of times they're releasing features, and sometimes included in that is they're fixing some kind of security vulnerability.
Bug fixes, is that the term? Absolutely. I see. Now, for the everyday person who's not in IT, who's not tech savvy, they notice a vulnerability somehow or another. Who would they call to fix things?
So generally, whoever's developing that application is going to have some type of contact form or something like that. Just go on their website, do a general contact form, and say, I found this thing, and I wanted to let you know about it. And some companies are going to be really good about responding to you. Some of them are not going to be. There's a whole term called responsible disclosure. You can ask Peter about as well, that if I'm what we call a security researcher, and I find a vulnerability in the program that you wrote, and I come to you and say, Donna, here's the program, here's the bug, and you ignore me or don't do anything, after a certain amount of time, what that researcher is, and there's no regulations around it really, but what they're allowed to do based on the common accepted responsibility disclosure is to go tell the world that there's a vulnerability. And what that's designed to do, that responsible disclosure time frame is generally like 60 to 90 days or whatever, is to give the company enough time to fix their bug to where the bad hackers don't know about it yet. Okay. They can't take advantage of it. If the company doesn't fix it, then you let the world know, and that at that point allows that company to go, oh, maybe I should have fixed this, and they'll do the right thing.
So you have to be a step ahead of the game.
You really do, because the bad hackers are out there looking for these vulnerabilities at the same time, and a lot of times that's what they do day in and day out. The good hackers slash what we would call security researchers they're not always necessarily just doing that, and sometimes people don't respond to them. It's a complicated.
Is there as many good hackers to, you know, supersede the bad hackers? I mean, is it?
No, not really. The problem is that you've got countries in the world and where their laws are typically either lax or they just don't enforce those, where a lot of those criminals have free rein and don't really have to worry about anybody coming after them and prosecuting them. So they tend to proliferate there, and if they've ethically are not concerned about it, then they can go do that anytime they want, and you've got the whole rest of the world who's trying to catch up to that. And then from the fact of they only have to be right one time, us as who's trying to defend it, you know, we have to be constantly diligent, and it's a really hard, it's not hopeless, Don. I don't want everybody thinking that, you know, this will never ever, it's not hopeless, but it is a hard job. So
the future of technology, and as someone who does voiceovers for a living, I have to ask about AI.
Yeah, deepfakes and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
If any of your listeners have watched, like, Matrix, or going to look at the new Matrix movie and mm-hmm. that kind of stuff, we're nowhere close to that. You know, or if you're a Star Wars fan and you think of C-3PO or R2-D2, that they can just go around and do all... We're not anywhere close to that.
God.
So yeah, they're not going to take over the world. Terminator's not coming for us anytime soon.
So the voiceover business is still going to be thriving for a while.
Well, let's not go there.
Oh.
That doesn't rely necessarily on artificial intelligence to get that done. There is what some people call artificial intelligence. It's not in the true sense really artificial intelligence, but the machines are getting smart enough with human help to do some really deep fake type stuff that is very, very difficult to distinguish from the real thing, voice and face. The voice stuff has been happening since the 90s with the voiceover work where you could, you know, say it and it would type it out right for you, and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. That stuff has been getting worked on for a long time, and we're reaching a point from a computing power perspective. We're getting much closer to what we call quantum computing, which is will allow us to have power in computers that will be way beyond what we have now. And that's not just a problem in your area. That's a problem in security as well.
Yes,
because it
right.
enables you to hack things at a much faster rate. So I still don't think, I'm not a professional in quantum computing, that kind of thing. I think I will probably be retired before that kind of stuff is really sustainable to that. But there's also proactive things that are happening now to try to already build stuff to help counter that. So it's a race. It absolutely is. I just wouldn't be terribly worried probably for the next 10 years.
I'm telling all my voiceover friends not to be too concerned. Michael Farnham says, be cool, yeah, be chill.
Let me put out there, you know, I'm knowledgeable in things, but don't take my advice as a letter of the law. I've got a disclaimer on everything I say.
Absolutely. And the future of technology, let's just say 10 years, 15 years. The fact that we can have a phone that we can see the person we're talking to. What else do you see this?
Yeah, well, I mean, but there are literally jobs out there where people are futurists. I'm always thinking about it. From a pure technology perspective, I think there are a whole lot of things that you can go into, self-driving cars, all of that kind of stuff. I don't think we're going to have flying cars. We're not in Back to the Future. Anything, you know, that was like, what, 6 years ago, all of that was supposed to be in place.
The Jetsons, you know, flying around to work. No, and
we're not close to that. But a lot of that comes down to from the perspective that it's not practical more than it is that we can't build the technology to do it. But there are certain things that, from my perspective, we have to build into the infrastructure in order to make them successful. Self-driving cars and things all rely on GPS and, mm-hmm. and apps and that kind of thing that aren't really that reliable, but they're a precursor to things like having things on the road that help guide your car, those kind of things. Those are all infrastructure upgrades that cost a lot of money, but are going to be the most reliable way of doing things. That's how I think of, from a technology perspective, is there's a whole lot of infrastructure that has to be put in place that we don't have. And that's going to, so there are things that get delayed. I think what we're seeing, instead of these huge monster things that we all think about from Back to the Future and all that, uh-huh. all of our technology is getting driven into things like the phone and that kind of thing. So it's actually getting built in much smaller packages that are changing our lives versus the huge packages that we saw in movies and that kind of thing.
Do you think the future will be better, faster? It's a good thing. All this technology, it's...
Technology is neither good nor bad, just like hacking. It all depends on what you do with it. Social media is an absolute bane on our existence in one way. And in the other way, it's absolutely fantastic because I get to watch my nieces and nephews and maybe one day my grandkids, you know, that's all there. I'm a very much a technology file on one side, and I'm a Luddite on the other side, where I won't have a lot of things in my house like Alexa's and all of those things, because I don't want to open my home up to those things, because those things can be attacked as well.
So they're listening to our conversation.
I can't say yes or no on that, and not because I'm trying to be cagey, because there's ways. Most things, when you get an email because you talked about dog food and you don't have a dog or something like that, most of that is just them taking data from all kinds of different sources of who you know and things like that. And they're just taking a shot that that's applicable to you. That doesn't mean they're listening to you.
Okay.
The possibility of someone taking advantage of those devices and listening to you is absolutely there. And I don't like that stuff. I don't need it in my life to make me more efficient. I'm old enough to where I've lived without it. I don't really have to have those things. I will say, though, I do have a Shark vacuum cleaner that's internet attached. My wife's washing machine has internet
attached. Oh, there you go. Okay.
I just keep those on a different network in my house so nobody can get to my other network.
The company you founded, HughesSecCon, what's coming up this year, in 2022 rather?
All right, so 2022, we're going to have a conference in October. So we just had our last one. We'll have a conference in October. We're very much in the planning stages, but we will be at the Marriott Marquis downtown, in downtown Houston, like we always are. We'll have a couple of days of deep geek thinking. We'll have, like I said, lock picking. We'll have hacking games that people can get in there and learn how to do all kinds of stuff. If you're at all interested, you're more than welcome. I think we're only like $100 a ticket or something. If you're not a cybersecurity professional, you're more than welcome to get a ticket and come. I just don't know that you're going to be highly entertained. So don't expect to come in. We will have some cool lights and things like that. But other than that, if it's not your game, you might not want to. We will have people that that come in and talk at different level, generally like our keynotes, presenters, that kind of thing. We had somebody come in a few years ago that was all about personal protection, physical personal protection, because he used to be special forces in Israeli army. So those kind of things, I tend to try to find the more entertaining things at the end. But you can ask Peter, most of it is pretty focused on cybersecurity professionals. But if you want to come learn how to pick locks, that's actually fun. A lot of people get a kick out of that aren't really technical, but they'll come and pick locks. And it's kind of fun to
It's good for your brain. Maybe I'll go.
My son and I helped our neighbor get into their house one time when they locked themselves out of their house. We got them into their house. So there's benefits to it. They were scared of us after.
Yeah, that was my next question. It was like, oh, don't let Mr. Farnham and his kid around. No, I don't think. I want to thank you very much for being a part of this. I know we're friends on LinkedIn, and I'm so glad that we are, because I've learned a lot about cybersecurity today and staying safe. And we're definitely going to have you back on again. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Donna, very much. It was an honor to be here. Really appreciate it. Thank you to everybody who's listening.
You've been listening to Spotlight Conversations with Donna Reed. Subscribe on Apple and Spotify podcasts or your favorite platform. Thanks for tuning in.